Easter is coming up, and I just can't wait to have the whole family in one place. And of course, what's Easter without an awesome Easter brunch? Now, I don't know about your family, but mine is a little picky, and I really wanted to impress them with something delicious. A friend told me I should check out Total Wine & More. It was crazy! They must have every wine and beer imaginable. I told one of their friendly experts my situation, and they found me just the thing. This sparkling wine is going to be absolutely perfect for brunch, even with my picky family. I know next time I need something, I'm shopping at Total Wine and More.
Welcome, everyone, to the NBA podcast presented by B-Ball Breakdown. I'm Brian Toporek, and joining me today, as always, are Morten Jensen and Sarah Chalea. How are you guys?
Doing good, for the most part.
Doing well, Brian.
Sarah, I don't believe that for a second. Well, Sarah here is our Spurs expert, and since we've talked to her the last time, the Spurs have been knocked out of the playoffs, unfortunately. They met their demise at the hands of the Oklahoma City Thunder in a six-game series. It looked like, at first, that the Spurs were just going to rampage through the Thunder. They beat them by 30-plus points in Game 1. But then the series really turned around in Game 2, and the Thunder never looked back, save for a Game 3 setback. So, Sarah, I'm curious, what happened? Where was the turning point in that series?
The turning point may have been when Steven Adams said, was it Game 2? Or game three, in which he had 2 points. And after the game, he said to reporters, you know, that he was focusing on defense, but that he needed to provide a little bit more offense as well. He said, got to do both, mate. And for the rest of the series, he did both. And not only that, but, you know, I think everyone knows what happened, right? The Spurs got destroyed on the boards, and they got destroyed off the bench, somewhat surprisingly. And that was the series right there.
Let's not forget the refs here. Not that I'm putting it all in the feet of the refs, but this was a weak-ass series in terms of refereeing. Like, so many missed calls, weird calls, not even picking up obvious fouls. It was weird, and I'm not trying to be the apologist and say that San Antonio would have won this series. I don't think they would have, because Oklahoma just came in and, like you said, Brian, dominated on the boards, or Sarah, you said, dominated on the boards and kept themselves in it. But holy hell, that was just so bad reffing almost throughout. It's kind of embarrassing for the league.
Yeah, I mean, you can make the argument. So there was the Game 2 debacle at the end with Dion inbounding to Manu and like 5 missed calls. And you can make the argument that San Antonio should have gotten the ball there, down 1, 13 seconds left. I mean, even still, they had a 3-on-1 fast break. They should have scored there. And that could have been them up 2-0 going to OKC. OKC needs to win 4 of the next 5. So that changes the complexion of the series entirely. And then Game 5, inbound, Westbrook gets the ball, Kawhi like shoulder tackles him, and they don't call. And then he gets the and one and puts him up 4 with a couple seconds left, basically clinches that game. So, Morten, to your point, I think that's fair. Like, the series is not all that far away from being 2-0 San Antonio and just having a totally different look. And I think that's the thing that is driving me a little crazy is I've just been seeing on Twitter so many people, like, dumping on the Spurs and burying the Spurs. But aside from Game 1 and Game 6, like, all of these games came down to the last possession. Like, it was not a blowout series either way. And just because, like, you know, San Antonio won 67 games and they were supposed to meet the Warriors, so it's a little disappointing that their season ended in the second round. But let's not act like OKC is a bad team by any means. Like, this is a great team that was just really inconsistent. And then finally, after getting blown out in Game 1, like, they put it together for their best 5-game stretch. So all the Spurs slander needs to stop. I'm going to stick up for Sarah here and just say it's, you know, they have some needs for sure. And this is not a perfect roster by any means, but they're not nearly as far off as public perception would have you believe.
Well, people are just pissed because they wanted to see Golden State and San Antonio in the conference finals. Mm-hmm. They wanted to see the two best teams go head-to-head, and I get that. Simply because you're not going to get like a fair representation of the best brand of basketball in the NBA finals, so they wanted to see the two primary candidates go at it at some point. And until further notice, that is like the San Antonio Spurs being better than Oklahoma City Thunder. Now we can actually begin to make the argument, is the Thunder the better team, or are the Thunder the better team? I don't have an answer for that. It was just a bad series for San Antonio, but in the end, people wanted to see that specific matchup. Like, remember how much that Spurs-Warriors series had been hyped?
Yeah.
Even before the playoffs, like, it's inevitable. It's going to happen. Right. Like, I've said it. You've said it. Sarah said, yeah, well, Sarah, you're so kind. You opened the door for everyone to be. Now, let me ask you this, Sarah. Here's a team that finally, in some regards, beat your Spurs. And I'm pretty sure you didn't think that was that would happen, right?
No, this year I didn't. I really. Yeah. I mean, I'm always open to the possibility. Like I said before, I made my wonderful Spurs in five pick. I said at the same time, you know, I wouldn't be shocked if they lost, and I'm not. But no, I thought that they should get through the Thunder this year. But as Brian mentioned, the Thunder were completely inconsistent all year. Or if anything, they were consistently disappointing, especially in fourth quarters. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
And then all of a sudden, they're closing better than the Spurs. Though to be fair, like I mentioned earlier as well, the Spurs haven't been the Spurs that we know this year. No. As far as closing, and you know, they didn't have to close a lot of close games this year, but when they had to, you could tell that, you know, they didn't have the same things to fall back on as they usually have had. And they did try like the same plays that they often run, but there's different pieces running them, so it was a little different for them this year too. But no, I'm not. I'm also happy to let you bring up Morton, the officiating. It was a poorly officiated series. Like, the whole playoffs haven't been good this year. And I was going to say on our last podcast that it's going to cost somebody a big game eventually. And I didn't. But, I mean, you know, it's true that there are always a bunch of things that each team could do better. But when you have a game that's, you know, especially in the playoffs, it's kind of evenly played. They both make about the same amount of mistakes, and then it kind of gets tipped by a call here or there at the end. That's why I told you guys that I didn't want to play that team, and you all laughed at me. You jerks.
Yeah.
I told you.
We forced you to be cocky, and as soon as you got cocky, San Antonio lost.
That's what happened.
So
see?
This isn't on you. This is on Brian and I.
Yeah.
I can get behind that. That's fair.
Yep.
That's
fair. It's all you.
Our teams didn't make the playoffs, so this is our way to have a rooting interest.
They're going to get the calls, you know, the free throws. In more of the games. There was a game that the Spurs had like 20 more free throws than the Thunder, which is an aberration. But other than that, it went about the way I expected it to go. But they didn't deserve to win. They didn't play well enough. So here we are.
Yeah, Sarah, I want to give you credit because you did say, even heading into the playoffs, the Spurs offense was not as fearsome as we have gotten used to, especially like, you know, you think of the 2014 finals where they just completely dissected Miami. And that especially late game against OKC, it turned into strangely like isolation basketball, which is what you expect from OKC more than San Antonio. So were there any adjustments that you would have liked to see Pop make earlier? Like, he turned to Boban in game six, but that didn't go so hot, and even tried Kawhi at the four a little bit. Like, Tony Parker literally never, ever, 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 ever guarding Russell Westbrook.
You know, he could have probably tried Boban a little sooner, but I didn't expect him to. Like, coming into the season, that was a slight question for me, was the fact that there really was no center on the roster except Boban, and you pretty much knew Pop probably wouldn't play him much in the playoffs. So, I mean, you thought maybe it'll be okay because, you know, the league's going small ball, but it turned out to be a problem. You know, I don't think it's a big deal that Pop didn't play him that much, even though he has experience, you know, overseas, even though he's 27 years old. Pop's not going to throw him into that kind of a series. You just knew he wouldn't. So, and there's no one else to go to. I may have liked to see him try to keep David West and Boris Diaw not in together, because that did not work out well. But there again, it's a thin front line, really. I mean, they're short. They're all small. There's not a lot of options there. What I can explain is, like, Patty Mills, all of a sudden, he didn't even get up a lot of shots. You know, it was weird the way that he played. David West, that elbow jumper that he was automatic all season long, almost all career long, it wasn't going in. You know, things just, the bench fell off a cliff. There's not a lot Pop could have done in that scenario. It just happened. So, oh well.
And Kyle Anderson guarding Kevin Durant on at times, not really something I want to see go forward for the Spurs.
Not ideal. Nope. Yeah, he did well in spots. You know, he uses his leg. Yeah. But yeah, no, you don't want to see too much of that.
Andre Miller, I just realized Andre Miller had more minutes played than Boban.
Wow. Oh. How did that happen?
It's only by one more minute, but still. Oh, okay. Like, that's not great. I mean, Boban played 19 minutes in this series, and Andre Miller and Kevin Martin both played 20. Boban was the guy of everyone who played the least amount of minutes. That's weird, especially given the amount of time you had Steven Adams in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, once they started getting beat on the boards that badly, I figured we'd get a little more Boban early. So that was my big surprise, even though he got beat like a racehorse once they put him in there. Like, they just targeted him in pick and roll every time. He got three quick fouls. Like, I forget, he was minus 13, I want to say, in game six. Like, he was not a big positive, but even just trying that a little bit earlier at least lets you know, like, okay, that's not the adjustment we're going to make. I don't want to be that guy, but R.C. Buford, Executive of the Year. We're going to go back to this for a second. You know.
Yeah, he is.
You know.
Stop yourself. Stop yourself, Brian.
I'm just saying, like, it took one adjustment from Billy Donovan to start playing Adams and Cantor, and the Spurs were just done. Like, okay. Yeah. Okay. Sure. Deserving Executive of the Year, though. You know, I mean, there's nothing Pop, like, could really do, because, as Sarah said, like, they don't have a real center to bang up against, against the Cantor Adams front line. It seemed like this roster was assembled to compete with the Warriors much more so than the Thunder. And once the Thunder exploited that size advantage, it was over.
Yeah, you're forgetting about Tim, though. Come on. I mean, here's the thing. None of us knew that Tim would not produce.
Yeah.
We all knew that during the regular season he was going to play limited minutes and not get a whole bunch of shots, but we all expected him to deliver in the playoffs. Like, this was not just us, it was everyone. Everyone expected Tim to become the double-double guy again in the playoffs, and it just didn't happen, and then suddenly you had this gap because Duncan was sort of the forgotten player, and he couldn't even deliver being the forgotten player. Like, you just switched off of him, and he couldn't do anything, basically, which is... Like, I'm about to cry when I say these words in connection to Tim Duncan, because that just does not fit together. But we're forgetting the fact that everyone counted on him. Like, I get what you're saying, Ryan. Totally, I get it. But we're forgetting about Tim here. He was a part of that plan. Like, R.C. Buford, Greg Popovich, they were hoping this guy could come in and be, like, not necessarily the old Tim Duncan, but did they expect him to shoot 36% from the floor? No. I mean, geez. No, but insurances, they should have had an insurance.
I agree with that. You're counting on a 40-year-old. Like, you know, he's timeless, and he has not fallen off on a per 36-minute rate ever. But, again, he's 40. Like, at some point, it's going to happen. So they were really playing with fire here.
We've said that for 6 years.
Yeah, but, you know, at some point, it had to happen. It looked like it finally did this year. But that begs the question, Sarah. So now the talk is of Tim. Was that his last game? Was that Manu's last game? Do you have any sense of whether those guys are coming back next year?
I have no sense. I don't even want to speculate, really. I just want them to do whatever they want to do, honestly. They don't owe us anything. And I don't, how some people in the media will say, oh, this guy's done, or, you know, he needs to hang it. No, I just think that's so disrespectful to say about a professional athlete. You know, we don't know. We don't know how a guy's feeling. So, I don't know. I'll have a lot of words to say once we get final word from either one of them. But until then, I don't really want to say too much.
Then I'm going to go on the record.
Go for it, Morten.
I think Tim is back.
Wow.
Because I think losing this series in the way that he lost this, I think he is so dissatisfied. And I think that we as an NBA community has never really appreciated Tim for the competitor that he is.
Mm-hmm.
And I would suspect that this loss, and especially the way it went down, leaves such a bad taste in his mouth that he is sitting there going, not like this. Even though he's the quiet guy and who never makes a fuss, never jumps up, says anything loud, he's sitting there and he is seething.
Yeah.
He's hating every freaking minute of this right now. And I think he's looking himself in the mirror and going, you know what? I don't care. I don't even care if I average the same numbers next year and if I don't shoot well from the floor. I need to be in there and go further and know that everything was left out on the floor collectively.
Mm.
That's my belief. I believe Tim Duncan is one of the most hardcore professional competitors we've ever seen, even though he doesn't show it, like in on his face and in his words. And I don't think we should underestimate just how badly this stings.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, personally, selfishly, I hope they're both back just because I feel like this season was the whole season was just the Kobe retirement tour. And we didn't really get a sense to appreciate like, oh, wait, this might be Tim's last season, too. This might be Manu's last season. Like, yeah. Tim, he is a better overall player than Kobe, right? Like, he had a better career than Kobe. He has a much more lasting impact despite not like having however many scoring titles. But like, if you're gonna put, you know, Bill Simmons like pyramid of basketball, Tim Duncan is ahead of Kobe. So for us to like, sure, give this whole like season-long farewell for Kobe and then being like, oh my god, it's game six, wait, this might be the last time we ever see Tim Duncan, like what? Like, I know Tim is not the type of person that wants a whole season long farewell. Like, he just wants to silently, like, this, if that was how he went out, he would much rather just go out quietly at a playoff game, like, not even get pulled ceremonially with a minute left. Like,
I loved that. Yes. I absolutely loved that he finished on the floor, whether it was his last game or not. I loved it.
Yeah. And that's what he would want, I would think. I mean, he even said after the game that, like, Pop asked him if he wanted to go back in. He's like, hell yeah, I do. I always want to play. So that's, even if he comes back, we're not going to give him this whole, like, showering with him with praise the whole season. But I would like the entire NBA community to have a chance to say, oh, Tim, you were great too. Like, Kobe, he was great. You were great. Let's share the love a little bit. So hopefully he comes back. The word is from ESPN's Mark Stein that they might go after Mike Conley in free agency. Sarah, what do you think about that? And are there any other major needs that you would like to see them address?
I think they should definitely take a look at Mike Conley, see what his interest is. And I think they will. I just don't know. Well, he probably won't come. That's the Spurs fan mentality, even though we finally got a free agent to come last year. But if he did, what do they do with Tony? Like, I can't see Pop, you know, he's not going to move him. And I don't think that he's going to bring him off the bench either. So that would be very interesting to me. I don't know. But yeah, I would love for Mike Conley to come here. That's been, I think we've talked about that before. The needs have been the same for almost the entire time I've been a Spurs fan. They needed a center. And, you know, they've had guys filling that role since David retired. Oberto was one of my favorites. But, yeah, they've never had, like, you know, a great center. They've always needed more help penetrating. You know, they've needed backup point guards a lot of time. We've got Patty now, who is more shooter than creator. And he's great at what he does. But, yeah, he needs help to get an offense going, and Manu has always been there to do that with him in the second unit. But Manu's getting older. You know, they're going to at some point need to replace what he does. Tony obviously is getting older too. So those are the main needs, would be somebody to create offense, to get into the middle of the paint, and another big, a real big, and a couple more shooters. But can I just say that I'm angry with Aaron Baines and his agent and the Pistons for depriving us of Aaron Baines versus Steven Adams. How much fun would that have been?
Oh my god.
That would have been so good.
Oh my, don't get me wrong, like Steven Adams is much more agile. He can move better. He probably still would have gotten the better of that, but it just would have been fun to see them collide, like, you know, the Aussie and the Kiwi.
Oh yeah.
Plus, wasn't I think Aaron was actually born in New Zealand, but he claims Australia. There's something interesting there. No, but that would have been a hell of a lot of fun.
I like the Fabricio Oberto name drop right there. I actually have a pretty, I have a pretty great story about that. Back in, I think 2007 or 2008, during the summer, I was working at like a daycare center. And there was this guy who was a Spurs fan, actually, and he was completely high on Oberto. And we had some talks, and then he started, like, opening up a little bit, and he said, you know what, I'm going to tell you something. Fabricio Oberto is better than prime Kevin Garnett. And I'm like, take it down a notch, big fella. Take it down a notch. That's not, no. And, yeah. So he went on a 20-minute long rant about how Fabricio Oberto was better than prime Kevin Garnett. And for like a year, I had so much trouble like just respecting Oberto because that that rant was just stuck in the back of my head. But when it finally got out, it's like, yeah, okay, this is a terrific player. But oh man, that was delusional Spurs fan in Denmark, apparently. Wow. That's, it's pretty crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. I love Fabby, but yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Prime KG might be a stretch.
Yeah, I think so. Oh, his pick and roll defense is better than... No, it's not. His pick and roll defense wasn't better than KP's. Stop yourself, Dean. Oh, well, we're crazy people.
Maybe they'll just bring him back this summer, but we'll keep an eye on the Spurs. They definitely loom. There's talk of Kevin Durant maybe wanting to go there, so they will be one of the more interesting destinations to keep an eye on. Want to change gears for a second, and since the Western Conference Finals are set, should talk about what we're going to get with Warriors Thunder. I think the first thing we got to ask is Russ versus Steph. How's that going to go? Who wins that battle?
Oh, man. I mean, obviously I'm going to pick Stephen Curry, but this is going to be a really tough one because it really depends on what kind of Russell Westbrook you're getting.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what kind of aggression is he playing with? Is he looking to score? Is he looking to facilitate? Is he... Mm-hmm. Towing the line between the two, what kind of Russell Westbrook are we gonna see? If he's like the Russell Westbrook who is gonna look at Stephen Curry and take the whole matchup personally, then holy hell, I wouldn't want to be Curry simply because you would have to establish yourself defensively to like a perverse degree,
right?
Which would leave him shorthanded, fatigue-wise, offensively, I think, especially coming off the injury. But no, I mean, I still got to choose the MVP. I mean, he can shoot Russ to death. And if he backs off a little bit and Russ is silly enough to keep taking the long ball, which could happen, then yeah. This is definitely Steph.
Coach Nick has done a video on B-Ball Breakdown about Steph being underrated defensively. So it's not like Russ is going to torch Steph like he did to Tony Parker whenever he was on him.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, Curry is quick. He's agile, got quick hands. So, yeah, he's going to put up a fight, but you just know that regardless of how good you are defensively, if Russ feels it and he's got the mojo going, he's got the speed going and he feels it, I mean, how do you stop that dude? He's like a blur, insanely strong athletic blur. I wish for myself to just be on the NBA court for one possession and just to stare down Russell Westbrook, just to have a full appreciation of just how strong and quick he is. I mean, my head would spin so quick it would snap.
Yeah, sure. You wouldn't even have a chance to see him before he blew by you and dunked on your head.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'd be okay with actually just standing on this sideline watching that happen.
Yep.
To you.
Exactly.
I'll get a sense for how quick he is that way, because I don't want him ever coming at me.
No, yeah, he's terrifying. I think, Morten, you touched on like the good Russ, bad Russ thing, and that's my question, because we saw bad Russ in Game 3 against San Antonio, and then it seemed like he was in his head a little bit in game four when KD went off for 41, but Russ was, I think he had 14 points on 5 of 18. Then games 5 and 6, we got like the full good Russ again. Like, he was aggressive. He settled for a couple bad shots here and there, but he definitely was looking to push the tempo at every chance. Like, every rebound, he was just flying up the court. So I think that's what you have to do against the Warriors, because they're going to score on you. It's a question of, can you score 100 back on them? We will see about Russ and Steph. Sarah, having just watched KD for 6 games, who do you think guards him in Golden State?
I think maybe they throw Klay at him. They're probably going to mix it up. Klay, Iguodala. They'll just try everything, I bet. If I had to guess, try to mix it up on him. It's so strange that, you know, he didn't have a good first round at all. He wasn't even great against the Spurs, except, you know, every now and then he just went supernova. And, you know, that's what he's going to do. And there will be nothing that you can do about it. The good thing for the Warriors is they have other people who can also go supernova. So, I don't, you know, it's going to be a fun series. But one reason that this Spurs loss, frankly, doesn't even register on the pain scale for me is that for the first time in probably 4 years, I didn't really think they had a good chance to win the championship. At least not a great chance. I did not think they were the best team because Warriors. So, yeah. You know, they're the favorites, no question. But I still think this is going to be an intriguing series. There's a lot of fun matchups. If Russell can go back at Steph and kind of just get him on his heels, maybe wear him down. I mean, the guy has ridiculous stamina, Steph, but he has just been out, you know, for a while. So if he could, you know, you never know. If Russ can try to wear him down. But my question for you guys, do you think that the two-point guards will guard each other very much, or will it get mixed up?
That's a good question.
Yeah, that is a good question.
I could probably see Klay taking times on Russ at times, like depending on matchups and if it's a half court set, and I could even see the Warriors go into a kind of a zone defense at times if they have a lineup out there where Durant is on the bench but Russ is in because he's not a strong shooter. It's a good question. I think they're gonna get matched up plenty overall in the series, but not possession by possession necessarily. It seems like Steve Kerr is just too clever to like play his hand up front, and it's like, okay, you're gonna guard this guy full time. No, he likes to switch it up and preferably on the run, and he adjusts accordingly all the time, which is why I think it's so tough to play against Golden State. I mean, you may have them figure out on your own accord in the first quarter, but then they'll mix it up in the second and third, and then when the fourth quarter rolls around, you're so confused that you don't really know where you have them at.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I think the biggest thing for me is not really who guards Westbrook. It's really Durant, as you guys touch upon. And I think it's going to be a combination, like you guys said, like Iggy, Harrison Barnes, Draymond, Klay. They're just going to throw a shit ton of players at him and see who does it best. And then they're going to switch. And if Durant plays off the pick and roll, they're going to have defenders leaning a little bit back. And oh man, they're going to have so many ways of just defending everyone on OKC. And that's really going to be the calling card for Golden State this series. Defense, defense, defense. I think the offense is going to survive either way.
For sure. Yeah, that versatility is going to be super, super clutch. Especially, I mean, if OKC keeps Andre Robertson in the starting lineup, don't you just leave him alone? Don't you just say, you know what, if you hit 3 threes against us, then we might adjust. But until then, we're just going to double KD and we're going to double Russ and we're going to let you stand in the corner and like force him to beat you. You know, like
could you put like Curry on him to save him?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't think you defend him. Like, I don't think you give him that respect until he starts making you pay for it. Like, I think you put Klay and Steph on Russ, or then like swing Klay into a double with Durant in a Russ Durant pick and roll, that kind of thing. Like, I don't think his offensive firepower merits a full-time defender until he can have a game like he did against the Spurs in game 6, where he actually did knock down a couple shots. But Russ and Durant are way too damn dangerous, so I think you put almost all of your focus on them, and then if the complimentary guys start beating you, that's when you maybe adjust. But I'm wondering also, like, say OKC takes one of those first two games, does Golden State alter its starting lineup and throw Iggy there instead of Barnes? Because I feel like Iggy's going to be the best matchup against KD. And I feel like you're going to almost have to mirror minutes. Like, whenever KD's on the court, Iggy's got to be on the court. So maybe you throw him in, and then Barnes can be your shooter off the bench. Like, maybe that will get him going offensively a little bit.
Well, if you call Barnes a shooter, I've really been down on Barnes overall.
Yeah.
I think he's become a little bit overrated, and that's not to be hard on Barnes, but everyone is like assuming he's going to get this max deal, and you know he just might, but when you look at what he's producing out there, I'm not all that impressed. I could get why you would make that switch. I don't think Kerr is a guy who would I'm not going to say panic, but I don't think he's the type of guy who would just make lineup changes just for the hell of it. But if it makes sense, and if he feels they really got smoked at that matchup, sure, I could see him adjust, but I think he's gonna stick with it. And then, I mean, when like you mentioned, Bri, when you're starting a game with Andre Robertson on the opposing team, you can hide guys so well, and you can save guys energy, and you can, I mean, I would probably start Curry up on Robertson just to like get his, you know, let him focus on offense, and then he can basically freestyle from there, and that's a huge advantage going into any game. So I think you really can have a ripple effect in that regard. But yeah, I mean, I wouldn't put it past him, no, but I doubt it still.
Yeah, something that I'm going to keep an eye out on. The only other big question that I have is, for OKC, who covers Draymond? Do you put Ibaka on him at first, or do you go right to Adams?
Man.
Yeah, man, that's the best answer out there. Like, you have no one who can really guard Draymond on OKC. Like, Ibaka can get to him when he goes inside, but Draymond is so clever. He'll know where Serge is and what he can do and what he can't do. Serge isn't that strong on the perimeter, so he'll go out there and facilitate or shoot. That's really the beauty of Draymond. He can create stuff from inside or outside, and he can just read his defender and know which way to go. I mean, Jeez, I really don't have any idea. Sarah, like, Serge, isn't he like the best call, really? I mean,
I'm just like imagining him trying to chase Draymond, though, and it doesn't look good.
Yeah. No.
No, not at all.
KD?
Yeah, I mean, that's possible, I guess.
That could be interesting.
And then hide Ibaka or Adams on Harrison Barnes.
Yeah. I would actually live with that.
Yeah, that's a good point. I was going to say Adams, definitely over Ibaka, because I think he's got the lateral foot speed to keep up with Dre, even on the perimeter. And that'll keep Ibaka close to the basket as your rim protector. I mean, Golden State doesn't use Bogut all that much in terms of offense. Like, he's definitely the defensive presence there. So I don't think, it's not like Golden State's just going to dump it down to Bogut every time and have him back down Ibaka, you know? Like, I don't think you're going to get... Not going to get abused if you're putting Adams away from the rim. And I feel like he has a better chance against Dre. I'm also curious to see if Enes Kanter is at all useful in the series, because he was really good against San Antonio, especially the Kanter-Adams front court. But I don't know how that works against Golden State's lineup of death. Like, if Dre's at the five, can you play two bigs against them?
Probably not. I mean, Enes Kanter against Draymond would be a clinic.
Yeah,
a complete clinic. I wouldn't even trust that matchup at all if I'm Billy Donovan.
Right.
I would probably hide Kanter on Bogut as much as I possibly could.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but at some point they'll make switches. At some point you'll have to get guys out there, and we are inevitably going to see Kanter guarding Draymond at some possession, and at some time, and we're going to laugh our asses off afterwards.
Yeah, it's going to be the first televised murder in NBA history.
Yeah. But really, KD, I mean, the more that I think about this, he's really the answer, isn't he, to guarding Draymond?
Yeah.
But, that's going to take so much out of KD.
I know. Mm-hmm. I know, that's the problem. I think that's the versatility of Golden State. I mean, that's been their calling card for 2 years, and that's really what's going to just pose so many problems, because they can go big with Bogut and Azealia if they want to. They can go to small, and most teams just don't have the personnel to make those type of fundamental wholesale switches. OKC beat San Antonio because it went big and thrived going big, but I don't know. Now, can you switch gears? Like, I agree. Mm. I don't think that Cantor and Adams front court has any chance. So,
are we forgetting also a matchup here that just plays so favorably into Golden State? Klay Thompson and Andre Roberson, if they choose to go with Roberson on Klay. Like, we saw when Curry was out how much Klay just stepped up.
Yeah.
And he created his own shot, and he was just—he was cooking, man. He was really cooking.
Yeah.
And against Roberson, he can do it. He can do the exact same. I know it's not CJ McCollum, but I would argue that CJ McCollum is quicker, more agile than Roberson. At least, I think Klay eats him for breakfast, and I wouldn't even be surprised if Klay ends up being the leading scorer of the entire series.
Wow.
He was so good against Portland. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, he was.
He would run off like 14 straight points.
I was impressed with what Roberson did on Kawhi, though. I thought, Sarah, you could probably speak to this better than I can, but I thought he actually did. I mean, Kawhi had that monster game one, but like Roberson really prevented Kawhi from getting into the flow of the offense until too late. Like in game six, he kind of tried to take over once they were down 25. And he started forcing the action and getting close to the basket. But, yeah, I mean, I was personally impressed by Roberson. I mean, you know, Klay is just such an elite scorer that I, no matter how good Roberson is on defense, Klay's still probably going to get 20 a game. But the question is it on, like, 12 shots or is it on 25?
Yeah, I agree, Brian. I definitely want to give Andre some credit because he did defend Kawhi really well. I think he could defend Klay pretty well as also. I'll be a little salty here, though, and say that he was allowed to hand-check the shit out of Kawhi. and apparently it's all of a sudden legal again. His forearm was on Kawhi's waist a lot. But he defended him really well. And he played so great in that final game, which, by the way, is one reason that, you know, of course, they've beaten my team twice now, but that's one reason that I just don't enjoy the Thunder. I'm not interested in the Thunder. It's because I feel like they have that potential all the time, and they never figure it out unless they're playing the Spurs in the playoffs. That's when they decide to put it all together, and Ibaka shoots 11 for 11, or Roberson shoots 3 of 4 from 3, or some crazy thump. Anyway, let me stop before I swear again. Anyway.
You're not salty at all, though.
Not at all. But yeah, no, I think he can defend Klay well. The thing with the Warriors is they kind of eliminate matchups in one-on-one basketball. They're going to run him through 8 million screens. There's going to be switches, and it's not going to matter. Because, you know, back in the day, before Kerr showed up, before they decided to start playing Draymond all the time, the Spurs always played the Warriors well because they had Danny Green and they had Kawhi. Kawhi always, you know, I wouldn't say shut down Klay, but he kind of held him close enough in check that, you know, everything else worked out okay for the Spurs. But that no longer is allowed to happen. You're not going to put your best defender on one of the Splash Brothers and have it stay that way. The Warriors know how to get to what they want. So that's the biggest issue with them.
That's a really good point. Quickly, let's go predictions here. Sarah, what do you see this series going?
God. I'm the worst at predictions, in case you guys didn't know. Let's see. I honestly kind of expect the Warriors to romp, because I think that the Thunder no longer playing the Spurs are going to revert back. But I don't know. I'll be generous and say Warriors in six.
Okay. Martin, how about you?
Well, you know, first of all, I agree with both your points about Roberson playing well, also on Kawhi. But I think because Kawhi, he was burdened a little bit with so much responsibility offensively, that carried into it a little bit. And that's true. I don't think that's the case with Klay. So I think Klay is going to exploit the hell out of it.
Right.
And I could see the Warriors take it in five. But like Sarah, I'm going to allow for some margin of error.
Mm-hmm.
And go six games for the Warriors.
Yeah, I want to go the same, but I'm screw it. I'm saying Warriors in five. I really think.
Oh, you know what? I appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you guys. Like, my heart says Warriors in six, but my gut just tells me that the Warriors, after getting Curry back, you know, he missed a good chunk of the first two rounds. I think they are not screwing around, and they've, you know, this OKC team probably caught their attention with how they dominated the Spurs. So I think they're going to be on their game. They'll take the first two in Oracle. They'll split in OKC, and then they're going to win game five, book their ticket back to the finals to play the Cleveland Cavaliers again. Because as we know, whoever the Cavs play in the Eastern Conference Finals, it's not going to matter. We are recording this on a Sunday, so game seven of the Miami-Toronto series has yet to happen. But let's be honest, guys. Like, it, I mean, the Cavs...
Doesn't matter.
No, right? Like, the Cavs... I don't even care who they play. I'm going to say the Cavs in four, right?
Yeah.
Maybe whoever they play gets a game. But nothing I've seen from Miami or Toronto, especially without their starting centers, suggests that they're going to do anything against the Cavs. So I honestly don't even want to talk about game seven here because there's nothing to say that we haven't already said. So instead, we're going to play a free agency quick hitter game. Because Miami, in particular, has a bunch of free agents coming up this offseason. So I'm going to say a name, then I want you guys to say how much you would feel comfortable paying them in free agency this year.
Under the new cap. So
projected $92 million cap. So that will increase the value slightly. So, Morton, I'm going to start with you. DeMar DeRozan.
Oh, I had a feeling you would start up with DeMar.
Yep.
Under the new cap. $18 million a year.
Okay. Okay. I don't hate that, actually, because he'd be eligible for about $25 million, I believe.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think if you get him anything under 20.
Yeah, and it's also, like, you're not being unrealistic in the sense, because he's still a 23-point scorer, and you just know that kind of scorer is going to get paid, right? I mean, someone is going to, like the Sixers, for example, they're going to be interested in a guy like that.
Ugh, please don't go down that road. Brian Colangelo drafted DeMar. Believe me, it is every night before I go to sleep, I have a nightmare of DeMar DeRozan in a Sixers jersey. Luckily, it sounds like he wants to go to the Lakers, and I think they're going to max him out, so let's hope that happens. But yeah, I agree. Based on what I've seen, I mean, he just can't shoot. You don't want a shooting guard who can't shoot. Like, it's as easy as that. You can't play a shooting guard who can't hit a three-pointer and pay him a max contract. So, I'm with you. I would not want to pay DeRozan anywhere near a max. Sarah, you talked about the Spurs needing a big. How about Bismack Biyombo?
Sure. I would pay him $4. No, I have no idea. Y'all know I'm not good with money, right? So... just think of me like Vladdy. I don't know what the hell's going on half the time.
Okay. Everyone gets a max.
Oh, that was gold. That was good.
Look,
I'm not going to come up with figures that make any damn sense. I don't know how the new cap is going to affect stuff. I know there's going to be a lot of money to throw around. But as far as anything less general than that, I got nothing.
I'm going to take Biyombo then. I'm going to say $8 million a year.
Oh, that's low.
I know. But I'm still worried about him offensively. I don't know that he can...
Yeah.
You know, like what...
No, I get that.
And you need you just need such a specific situation in which he's going to thrive. I don't know if he is your starting center that you're going to be great on the glass. He's a pretty good shot blocker. But it's not like he's DeAndre Jordan where it's like, all right, you just throw it down low and he's going to dunk everything. I mean, maybe I would go up to $10 million, but I mean, this, by the way, should be an example of just how screwy things are going to get this summer. Because what Bismack signed for looks like 2 years, $5.5 million with a player option this year that he's assuredly going to decline. So he got less than $3 million a year last year, and now he's probably looking at an eight-figure annual salary this time around.
I mean, look, he had a career high in scoring rate, in rebounding rate from the free throw line. This guy, he is looking better and better and better. I just think NBA teams are going to pick up on that and they're going to offer him a hell of a lot more than $8 million, though.
Yeah, you're Bulls. Like, if you could, you're Bulls need a center.
Hey, possibly. I rather him than Pau Gasol.
Yeah, yeah. $10 million for like, him versus 20 yeah. is Pau. I think it's a clear choice definitely. Right there.
Definitely. I would not mind Bismack Biyombo in Chicago at all. I really think he's a terrific defensive-minded player, and it seems like his offense is slowly coming along a little bit, though I do have my reservations about it, obviously. Yeah. But yeah.
All right, Martin, we'll do two more here. So the first, Dwayne Wade.
Oh, you are giving me the tough ones here today.
Because sure am.
Dwayne, you know, I've thought about Dwayne as a free agent for a while now, and I just can't peg him down.
Yeah.
Like, then he goes all 2009 on Charlotte's ass, right?
Right, yeah. And this series, too, he's been pretty damn good against Toronto.
Yeah, all right. Like, right now, at this point in time, it's 9:21, and tip-off for Game 7 against Miami and Toronto is in 9 minutes. And if he goes 2009 Wade again tonight... in 9 minutes' time, that is going to bump up that salary of his for the next few years. And I know he was holding out last year, hoping to get more. Miami is probably going to pay him like a lifetime achievement award contract thing. Would you be surprised if he got a 4-year deal worth $22 million?
Oh my god!
It's a hell of a lot of money. But would you be surprised to see Miami do that as sort of a good faith thing?
I wouldn't. I mean, just a 4-year deal for a guy that age.
Oh, I know.
You're asking for trouble. And you
could like make the final year, two final year could be like team options or like some sort of non-guaranteed, whatever.
Yeah, I wouldn't be shocked. I mean, so the problem is for Miami, they don't have early, or they only have early bird rights on Hassan Whiteside, so they can't exceed the salary cap to re-sign him. And Dwayne Wade has a massive cap hold this year. So they're going to have to handle Wade and Luol Deng before turning to Whiteside. But if you give Wade that kind of money, you're almost guaranteeing that you lose Whiteside. So if you go the 4-year deal route, maybe you give him like 4 years, $60 million. Otherwise, I could see, I mean, he's getting paid $20 million this year. Like, God, 2 years, $50 million. That's...
But is he going to take $60 million over 4 years, though? Like, remember last year, he was holding out.
Yeah,
he felt disrespected.
Yeah.
Like, that was the word being thrown around by the media, at least. He felt disrespected, and he settled, in his word, I believe, settled for a one-year $20 million deal. When you settle for $20 million, it means you're looking for far more than that next year.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be a shitstorm.
Yeah, there's no shortage of teams with the money to sign him. And based on how he's played in the playoffs, we'll throw it back to Vlade Sera over there. Like, I think the Kings are going to... They would immediately sign him to a 3-year max, wouldn't they? Like,
totally.
Yeah,
totally.
So you have a point. I if I'm the Heat, I'm looking to get him at a discount just so I can keep Whiteside. But I don't know how plausible that is. But Whiteside's the last one I want to tackle. I mean, personally, I'm maxing him. I have no hesitation doing it. What about you guys?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm probably going to do it too, even though I'm not happy about it.
Yeah.
I'm not really that happy about it. I mean, he does still have some issues.
Right.
Maturity issues, chemistry issues.
Yep.
He doesn't really fit the mold of the new center.
Yeah.
But no, he's just, you know... He's too damn talented not to, right?
Yeah.
I think anybody who wants him, like you said, they're probably going to have to max him. But yeah, you shouldn't be psyched about it because some of the things that come out of his mouth. But you know what, though? You're joking about Sacramento, but that would be hilarious, him and Boogie, if they could have them together. Like,
oh, my God.
He was drafted there.
Oh, yeah, man. He was. That's true. Yeah, that would be a chemistry nightmare.
It would be so fun. I would actually watch the Kings.
That would be a nightly league pass alert. Yeah, that's actually a good way for us to seg into our Where Amazing Happens segment. Once again, coaching themed, because we've got a couple, two hires and one abrupt resignation. So we'll start in Sacramento, where the Kings hired Memphis's Dave Yeager. Yeager stepped down, I believe, on the previous Saturday, and the Kings hired him 2 days later. So if the Kings bring in Whiteside to pair with Boogie, I think we all have to say a prayer to Yeager, right?
Oh, we're saying a prayer regardless. It's Sacramento.
Yeah. But based on the personalities that he had to handle during his time in Memphis, like when Zebo came, he had some reputation issues. This past season alone, he had Matt Barnes and Lance Stevenson on his team. I think, you know, Tony Allen has even threatened to, like, flagrant foul Mike Conley if he leaves Memphis this summer. So it's not like Yeager is not experienced with some colorful personalities, we'll put it that way. So I kind of love this hire for the Kings. I mean, not only does he have that working in his favor, but he's also, like, he dragged that Memphis team this year. They had no business making the playoffs once Marc Gasol and Mike Conley went down, and he dragged them across the finish line. So it's like he's been a very successful coach over the past couple of years. I mean, the question is, can you connect with Boogie? Because the one coach that did, Mike Malone, that was the best the Kings have looked in years. And then Boogie got, what do you have, meningitis, I think, and was out for 2 weeks, and they fired him, and now it's been straight downhill since. So
the Kings, everybody, clap,
yep,
clap, clap.
Yep.
Yeah, but are the personalities the biggest problem? Because I'd be more concerned about the front office.
Yeah, so that's a good point.
Like, that's, coaching is not really the problem here. Oh, well, okay, George Karl wasn't helping in that regard, but I do think Dave Yeager is the way to finding the correct path, if you catch my drift. He's like a very nice first step. Now you just need to find out what the hell you're doing in the front office. Mm-hmm. What the hell, what kind of role ownership really should have. Maybe Vivek Ranadive should just take a chill pill once in a while.
Yeah.
But yeah, at least Yeager has the potential to being that stable dude in the entire managerial level. So that's a positive sign. And I agree. I think he is by far the best coach you brought in since Mike Malone to handle Boogie.
Yep.
And I could totally see Boogie and Yeager hit it off.
Yeah. I mean, personally, I'm hoping they don't, because I want Boogie to get the hell out of Sacramento and I want him to get traded. So I love Boogie, and you know, I don't wish ill upon Yeager either, but I want Boogie freed. So we'll see what happens there. You know, you mentioned stability, and one place there is not stability right now is the Orlando Magic, as Scott Skiles. So it sounds like, from what I've read, Magic personnel expected him to go to the draft combine on Wednesday. And then Thursday, out of the blue, he decides he's going to resign and he doesn't want the job. So that's not great. It sounds like Frank Vogel is the hot name in the coaching search. But Patrick Ewing, Adrian Griffin, and James Borrego, the latter of whom was the interim coach there for a little bit, have also surfaced as other candidates. Who would you guys like to see end up in Orlando?
Well, Patrick Ewing has had such a rich history with the Orlando Magic. Remember when he played there? My God. That was such a wasted season. Now, I would like to see Pat get a try for a head coaching gig, but Frank Vogel is such a tough guy to turn down, mm-hmm. if you ask me. He is so good. I think he is by far the best guy on the market right now. And I think Orlando would be silly to not sign him if they get a chance. But, like, what the hell with Scott Skiles? That came out of freaking nowhere.
It really did. Well, there were rumblings at one point, apparently, that I think it was in January, where he said he, like, went to Rob Hennigan, the general manager, and expressing second thoughts about taking the job. It sounds like there were some conflicts between him and the front office, especially with Elfrid Payton. The front office believes Payton is the point guard of the future. Skiles very much did not, which at least partially explains that otherwise inexplicable Tobias Harris trade for Brandon Jennings. Seems like it was to get Skiles another point guard not named Elfrid Payton. So, I mean, the Magic have said their top priority is bringing in a defensive-minded coach, so it seems like Vogel really fits the bill there. But yeah, I mean, as a Georgetown guy, I'm a huge homer. I want Patty Ewing to get a job somewhere. It doesn't sound like it's going to be the Knicks. So,
Sarah?
I can't disagree with anything that you guys have said as far as Vogel. I don't really have a preference, though. I'm with Brian. I wouldn't mind seeing Patrick get a shot, but I really don't care. I'm so tired right now, y'all, for real. Whoever ends up coaching Orlando, I could care less. I could not care less. Sorry.
That's fair. All right. Well, we'll touch on the one other one then. This broke Saturday night. Indiana has promoted Nate McMillan, who is an assistant coach there, to be its new head coach. And my only reaction is WTF. Like, what? What? So, Larry Bird, when he didn't renew Vogel's contract, basically made it sound like we want a guy who's more offensively minded, who's going to run more small ball, who's going to run faster. And John Schumann of NBA.com shared this great chart last night. In 9 of his 10 full seasons, his teams have ranked in the bottom 6 in pace. So from 2005 onward, they were 28th, 29th, 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 30th, and 30th.
That's not good.
Not good. So to be fair, in that 10 years, he had 4 top 5 offenses, and he was 7th in 2009, 2010. So it's not like his slow pace is necessarily... It's not a death knell. Like, he can have an efficient offense with a very slow pace, but it really doesn't seem to fit the mold of what Larry Bird wants.
No, not at all. And it's a weird signing. Also one that came out of nowhere. I hadn't even heard rumblings about it at all.
No.
And like Nate McMillan, I actually liked his stint in Portland. I don't think he got the fullest out of the roster though, but I thought he was on his way to maximizing the effort of the roster. Whether he's going to pick that up with Indiana and their roster is kind of in a flux, you don't even know if Paul George is going to be there long term. I don't know. It seems like a stepping stone hire. Like, you use him for now, and in a year or two, you're going to get someone else. I just can't imagine Indiana looking at McMillan as the long term coach on the sideline if they have any aspirations of making a deep run into the playoffs.
Yeah. I mean, in McMillan's defense for Portland, you know, he had the whole Brandon Roy knee saga. That definitely didn't help. And then the whole Greg Oden over Kevin Durant thing. That team, like, they could have had a big three of Roy, LaMarcus Aldridge, and Oden, and they could have been a lot better. So, you know, the roster itself is not his fault. It is worth noting he's had a top 10 defense, and that's really where Indiana has been making its name for the last half decade under Vogel. So even if he runs a faster pace and gets the offense going, I wonder if it's going to have negative effects defensively, you know, especially if you're going into the season thinking Miles Turner is your starting five. I mean, I love the kid. I thought he was excellent, but it's a lot of responsibility to put on a second-year player who's still kind of skinny.
kind of, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm just kind of... I just don't... I mean, it doesn't even seem like... You know, all these other teams, the Kings and the Rockets especially, have been leaking like all of these reports about who they're interviewing. You know, like, the Kings have interviewed everyone before they hired Jaeger, and the Rockets still have an opening. Yeah, as you said, Morton, like, there was no smoke behind this. Like, all of a sudden, it was just like, oh, okay, we have Nate McMillan as our head coach. Like, it doesn't seem like they had a full interview process, which reminds me of the Sixers and their new GM search and how well that worked out. So,
yeah. This is the Wild West. It's been the Wild West of the NBA lately.
It really has.
I mean, it is so many weird stuff coming out of the woodworks, like, and J.B. Bickerstaff, you know, renouncing his rights to go after the Rockets job. Like, you know, the coaching carousel just moves on, and next year is probably going to get even worse. It's I would really love to see more coaching stability in the NBA.
Yeah,
but it's about that time to wrap up the podcast. And Brian, I just have to make one note before we wrap up.
Yeah,
you actually inspired me a little bit.
In
the sense of going back to the Thunder Warriors series, when you said that the Warriors are probably going to look at OKC as like, okay, this is a team we just got to kick the living poop out of, and we're going to be ready. And I was trying to be very non-controversial, and I started thinking, you know what, screw it. Dubs in four.
Dubs in four. Wow.
Sweep, wow. Baby, sweep.
There we go. All right, that is, what a note to end on. There we go. All right, well, thanks again, listeners, for joining us. This is the NBA podcast presented by B-Ball Breakdown. Be sure to check out bballbreakdown.com for all of your playoff coverage. We've had recaps of every game. Sure, we'll have series previews once this Eastern Conference semifinals mercifully wraps up. Next time we record, it will be after the draft lottery. So I will either be in a great mood or I will be silent for the entire hour. Until then, Morton and Sarah, it's always great talking to you guys.
Likewise, Bri.
Great to talk to you.
All right, take care.
Welcome to Total Wine & More. It's much more than a wine store. It's the eighth wonder of the world.
When people talk about Total Wine & More, they get a little carried away. We're just a big, friendly place run by people with a passion for wine and beer. See, we travel the world to find the best wines from the best regions, and we sell them at the lowest prices anywhere.
And friendly, helpful experts at every turn.
You know what? Maybe we are the eighth wonder of the world.
Shop in-store or online at TotalWine.com.
Welcome to Total Wine & More. It's much more than a wine store. It's the eighth wonder of the world.
When people talk about Total Wine & More, they get a little carried away. We're just a big, friendly place run by people with a passion for wine and beer. See, we travel the world to find the best wines from the best regions, and we sell them at the lowest prices anywhere.
And friendly, helpful experts at every turn.
You know what? Maybe we are the eighth wonder of the world.
Shop in-store or online at TotalWine.com.